Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the VTE Prevention from Quality to Safety conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. There is no web presentation. This is an audio conference only. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, March 11th, 2009. I would now like to turn the conference over to Bill Serrell, Vice President, Premier Research Services. Please go ahead, sir.
Great. Thank you, Moira. Greetings from Premier in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we help hospitals improve clinical and financial performance. And I'm very happy to welcome you to the program today, VTE Prevention from Quality to Safety. My name is Bill Zerald, and I'm your host today. And I'd like to start off by introducing our speakers and give them a moment to greet you. First, we welcome to our program Alpesh Amin, MD, MBA, Executive Director, Hospitalist Program, Medical Director, Anticoagulation Services, Vice Chair for Clinical Affairs and Quality, Department of Medicine, University of California, Irvine. Dr. Amin, would you mind greeting the audience and telling them a little bit about yourself?
Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here online with you guys to talk about a very important topic in this month, especially being DVT Awareness Month. Bill kind of outlined some of the things that I'm involved in, and looking at managing disease states from a patient safety and outcomes perspective is something that I've been involved in and have done a fair amount of work in, and also worked with the Premier. So hopefully we'll be able to talk about some of the outcome measures that we've been able to get over the last few years.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to now introduce our second speaker, Franklin Mishoda, MD, and Director of Academic Affairs in the Department of Hospital Medicine for Cleveland Clinic Foundation. Dr. Mishoda, would you mind saying a few words?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Bill, and welcome to everybody who's joining us today on the call. Calling today from Cleveland, Ohio, where the sun is shining, so it must be a good day. And talking about DVT or PE prevention has been an important part of my career to this point. I have been involved just as a physician taking care of patients and local strategies to help ensure adequate DVT prophylaxis, but have also been a steering committee member of the Coalition to Prevent DVT, which has been directed towards raising public awareness about this disease state, as well as gaining some payer as well as governmental awareness to the barriers of DVT prevention. And have also been involved with the Joint Commission and the National Quality Forum on the development of quality measures surrounding DVT, functioning on their technical advisory panel. So looking forward to talking about a lot of different issues, both at the local, regional, and national level, in terms of strategies designed to improve patient care and patient safety around this disease state.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Mishoda. So just to give you all an overview of the format, I will be interviewing the speakers for the first 40 minutes. Your phone lines have been placed on mute for the interview portion. Then we'll open up the lines for you to ask questions or make comments live, so please do jot down your questions as we go along here. Again, this is an audio-only conference, so there is no presentation along with it. Tomorrow, the audio file will be available on our website at premierinc.com/advisorlive. So let's get started, and I'd like to start with Dr. Amin. I'll be posing questions to both of the presenters, and they can share their different approaches and experiences with VTE prevention. So Dr. Amin, if you don't mind, the first question is, what is the incidence rate of VTE?
Yeah, so venous thromboembolism, as you all are aware, is a spectrum from DVT to pulmonary embolism, and the incidence has been estimated to be on the order of about 2 million cases of deep vein thrombosis, or DVT, and about 600,000 pulmonary embolism cases that occur. The mortality rate has been also estimated on the order of about 10% in the hospital as a result of venous thromboembolism. And there's complications that occur besides mortality, such as pulmonary hypertension in about 5% of the cases, and a cumulative incidence over an 8-year period of post-thrombotic syndrome approaching close to 30%. So it is a relevant and significant disease state that we deal with in the hospital setting. And as we've been aware and more acutely aware that in today's day and age, in 2009, if you start just thinking about the patients that actually come into the hospital setting, the patients tend to have 3, 4, 5, 6 risk factors. And the literature has actually shown that, and they're usually not very mobile. So we have a population of patients that are at significant risk for venous thromboembolism in the hospital setting. And this is not an issue that that only pertains to the surgical population. I can tell you that when I was in medical school, I learned about VTE prevention from our surgeons rotating on surgical services, but never heard anything about it on the medical side. But we now know that somewhere on the order of 50 to 60 to 70% of all VTE at-risk patients occur in the medical population, which approaches somewhere between 7 to 8 million folks, whereas somewhere on the order of 4 million or so folks, post-surgical patients, are at risk for VTE. But the point of that is that the risk is prevalent throughout our hospital setting.
And, Dr. Amin, why is it a major quality target?
Well, I guess the one way to look at this is that if there was nothing we could do about a disease state, then one would say, okay, it's there, but we have opportunities to actually improve and decrease the risk of venous thromboembolism in our patients in the hospital. And we have newer therapies that have come out over the last two decades, including low molecular weight heparins. We traditionally had unfractionated heparins. We have factor 10 inhibitors. So we have agents that are available to help decrease the incidence of venous thromboembolism. And there have been several studies that have shown that one can decrease the relative risk of venous thromboembolism by doing the right thing by as high as 60%. So that's significant. But the second thing is also there is this culture of habit, if you like, and part of improving quality and patient safety is setting up a process, a system, and encouraging, acknowledging that if one did something, they could improve the outcomes of that. And, you know, I liken it to some degree that every time we sit on an airplane, we have a standard in our practice. The air hostesses tell us to fasten our seat belts. They go through their safety checks. The pilots go through their safety checks, and that makes us feel more comfortable sitting on an airplane. Well, we can probably put our systems in place in the hospital to do the same thing, and we already have studies out there that ensure that we're able to decrease the risk of venous thromboembolism as a result of doing the right thing. And I would say one other thing. As Dr. Mashoda said, there have been a number of national organizations that have viewed this as an opportunity to improve quality and patient safety and decrease that rate of post-thrombotic syndrome, pulmonary hypertension, or mortality that occurs due to VTE. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality named it as one of its top 10 safe practices in the United States back in 2001. The National Quality Forum and the Joint Commission are working very closely together to define core measures within the hospital setting to reduce venous thromboembolism. The Surgical Care Improvement Project is looking at VTE as one of its four major areas that can decrease post-operative complications by 25% in 2010. So there's a number of national organizations that have backed this, and even folks like the LeapFrog group who has backed and endorsed the NQF measures around VTE prevention. So all of this put together, the evidence, the fact that there are national organizations, the fact that we can change our culture, and the fact that there are actual professional national guidelines by the American College of Chest Physicians or the International Angiology Guidelines that state that there's evidence to support what we do to reduce the risk of VTE puts us in the arena of patient safety and quality.
You know, Bill, I would also jump in as well to just make the comment that the other reason that this is such an important quality target is that every time that we've looked at how well we actually prevent DVT, whether it's in the United States, whether it's worldwide, whether it's starting in a population with the outcome, such as DVT, or even in specific disease states, such as heart failure, we don't do that well in preventing this disease. In fact, a lot of our data would suggest that only about half of patients who are known to be at risk ever receive a preventative therapy. And we've shown this now repeatedly over the last decade. So the other reason it's such an important quality target is everything that Dr. Amin just mentioned, but also the truth that in our literature, over and over and over again, we are relying on individual clinicians to remember to do one thing in one patient, and we're not getting the results that we should be getting, which is why the emphasis has been on a system of care approach so that nobody falls through the cracks, nobody gets missed.
Yeah, and this
Dr.
Rowley,
thank you very much, and let's stay with you for a moment, if you don't mind. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been going on at the Cleveland Clinic, and in particular, what processes have been developed to prevent VTE?
Yeah, there have been a lot of people at my organization that have been working on this particular project, actually going on now over multiple years. This is, in fact, a quality project that we have here. We have an organizational unit called the Quality Patient and Safety Institute, and so this has been a dedicated project that's been assigned to a work group within that institute, and they've pulled together a multidisciplinary task force that has been meeting regularly, really on the order of a couple of years, to try to standardize how we do this across our entire organization. We used to have, you know, prior to this, pre-printed order sheets, and we had a lot of protocols that were specific to the specialty or the department, but this is really more encompassing so that it applies to everyone. We have been on an electronic medical record now for over 2 years in the hospital setting, over, I think, now 10 years in the outpatient setting. So we finally have our kind of universal VTE prevention program built into our electronic medical record. And in fact, it's something that it allows us not only to make sure that everyone's looking at things the same way, it not only links background information for the clinician so they get point-of-care decision support tools, but it also allows us to track practices and link that with individual outcomes. So we're in the process now of not only having that here at the main campus, Cleveland Clinic Hospital, but this electronic medical record also goes to our 9 system hospitals as well, and that's really kind of the next phase is to really move this to all of the system hospitals. We'll have a great opportunity, I think, to track information and link that with outcomes and ultimately make sure that patients who are at risk get identified and get appropriate preventative therapies.
And can you talk a little bit about the role of the quality department within your institution for DVT prevention and how it relates to the institute you just spoke about?
Yeah, well, the Quality Patient Safety Institute is our version of the quality department. And, of course, part of their responsibilities is to evaluate all of the different quality measures for which our hospital has to report, but also to identify improvement opportunities that will improve patient care here at my organization. And they've really been kind of the backbone behind any of these projects. Anytime, multiple departments get together, things sort of fizzle out if there isn't somebody there to make sure that the motivation and the passion stays there. And that is in our quality group that has made that happen. It probably would not have happened were it not for their their participation. So they're kind of, you know, they're the glue that holds everything together, and they really do, and all with all kudos to them, they do all the work. We provide all the ideas, and we provide perhaps the physician sponsorship, but they actually get the work done. And I think the quality department plays a critical role in hospitals. You know, physician champions are necessary, I think, to get buy-in from the staff at large. But very often they don't have the motivation, the time, or the expertise to really make this go through the entire hospital, which I think is critical.
And what would you describe as some of the benefits related to the implementation of the DVT prevention services?
Well, I think certainly it for one thing, it highlighted the disease state perhaps among some of our staff that this wasn't an issue that they were focusing on. People who maybe were outside of the, not necessarily in taking care of patients that this was often talked about. In other words, orthopedic surgery has always been focused on DVT prevention. Arguably, the surgeons have as well. Interestingly, the cardiologists here have not always been focusing on prevention of venous disease. They're more focused on arterial disease. And so by applying this kind of universal approach, it's required them to think and document in a way that's analogous to what they do on orthopedic surgery or general surgery or on a medically ill service. So I think that it's helped preventing people not being recognized. It means that everybody who comes through is either getting prophylaxis or there's a risk assessment documented as to why they don't need it. And I think it's going to decrease the numbers of patients that we have who fall through the cracks and maybe don't get prophylaxis because there's so many other things going on the clinician just forgets. This system doesn't allow the clinician just to forget. And it also is visible for the nursing staff, for other providers and consultants who might see the patient. This information is presented in such a way in the chart that it's available to everybody. And of course, the ultimate outcome then is that you'll prevent symptomatic events by applying uniform prophylaxis when people at risk.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'd like to turn back to Dr. Amin and ask really the same questions with respect to what's happening at UC Irvine. Can you talk a little bit about the processes that the organization has developed to prevent VTE?
Yeah. Let me, just before I talk about it, I want to go, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to just go one step back to what Dr. Mashoda said before he answered the previous question, which is, you know, the fact that our data shows that we're not performing to the level that, to the optimal level, and that's been repeated. Just to bring it home, where Premier has been involved in with its organizations, we've done some studies that have looked at just the Premier hospitals and have found that, patients that are at risk for venous thromboembolism in the medical population as well as in the surgical population, only about two-thirds of patients are actually getting VTE prevention. But when we ask the question about whether they're getting it appropriately based on national guidelines, only about a third of those patients are actually getting VTE prevention. So this shows that there is obviously an opportunity to improve, and I only bring this up because of this conference call. The hope is that even looking at one's own data, one can see that there is opportunities to improve. Now, to answer your question, Bill, in regards to University of California, Irvine, which is my institution, the process that we took to actually make improvements in VTE prevention kind of came about in two steps. The first step was unknowingly about 12 years ago when we first started our hospitalist program, the institution had wanted to move away from paper orders and move to physician order entry. And so I was the first hospitalist at our institution, and so they actually asked me to help develop the physician order entry process. And we spent a couple of years using our current online system to develop physician order entry. And for the last decade or so, we've had over a 95% compliance in terms of physician order entry. So then then fast forwarding to about 6 years later, we have also a performance improvement quality department within our institution, and under that we decided to form a committee looking at venous thromboembolism prevention as a performance improvement project. And the fact that we already had physician order entry already happening in our institution, we decided to mandate that prior to anybody being able to finish their orders, they would have to address the issues around venous thromboembolism prevention when they admit a patient to the hospital. And when I made that proposal, there was a fair amount of pushback within members of the committee saying, you can't mandate people to do stuff like that. So I took it to medical executive committee, and we actually got the buy-off that it was okay to do that. And yeah, we're a level one trauma center, and so obviously we have to be able to bypass those orders in case an emergency comes in and we have to order a CT scan, or the trauma surgeon has to do that. But aside from that situation, we have screens that force people to finish the VTE prevention piece of the order set before they finalize the order set, and that has improved our compliance rate from about a 30% compliance rate all the way up into the high 90s almost instantaneously within a couple of months. And it was a good project because it was system wide. You know, everybody. It took some education, but everybody bought into it. But we had a system in place to help facilitate it. The hospitalists became cheerleaders for this process within our organization, along with certain surgeons and cardiologists. And so it was a nice process that actually improved our rates across the entire institution. We can evaluate when people are bypassing the order screens, and if we find out that it's inappropriate, then we can sit down with that department and say, look, we expect people to follow the rules here, and that's been a good thing. What we did, one of the things I would caution, though, is that we also, us being a training center and an academic medical center, people can easily get into kind of a habit of just saying, okay, I'm going to fill in, I'm going to order something for VTE prevention. And we had very few cases of people's platelet counts being extremely low, less than 10 or 20,000, and somebody might be ordering an anticoagulant. Well, you have to watch that and ensure that people don't just take the system's advantages too far that it impacts patient care. But once you keep an eye on that and do some education, actually having a systems approach can be very, very valuable.
Great. Thanks very much. Back to Dr. Mashoda, I'd like to ask you, what have you experienced in your approach to meet National Patient Safety Goal 030501 on anticoagulation safety?
Well, you know, this patient safety goal is actually quite broad in terms of, you know, having systems in place to ensure safety with anticoagulation. And obviously then you have to analyze your own processes of care and try and find the, you know, what points is there in fact the greatest potential risk or harm. I think that, you know, at least in terms of how we've approached it here, again, this is all housed within our Quality Patient Safety Institute, is to try to standardize our documentation as well as our reporting surrounding the use of anticoagulants. And in fact, one of the things that has just recently been added to our electronic medical record is something that's called the Anticoagulation Navigator, which is a special tab on our EMR. And it doesn't matter who is managing a vitamin K antagonist, whether it's our anticoagulation management clinic or an individual physician in a department somewhere, all the documentation regarding the use of that anticoagulant is presented in a standardized way where we can look at all of the drug doses that the patient has seen, what the weekly maximum dose of the vitamin K antagonist is the patient missing any doses, were there any bleeding symptoms that were documented at that visit, and so forth. And again, the value of tying this to the electronic medical record is wherever the patient goes, this information is available. But we've similarly had systems in place on the inpatient side for either sentinel events that involve anticoagulants that go through not only through pharmacy, but they go through the Quality Patient Safety Institute for root cause analysis and review. So we have ways to track adverse events and investigate. We have ways to standardize the use of anticoagulants, both in terms of vitamin K antagonists and outpatient care, as well as standardizing protocols on how we use anticoagulants on the inpatient side, and decreasing this variation and how we deliver these agents, of course, has been associated with improved patient outcomes. So efforts to standardize and having systems in place so that information is available to all providers across the organization, including transitions of care, are obviously all part of the way that we approach this national patient safety goal.
And for other facilities that may not be in the same position as Cleveland Clinic, any specific suggestions on how they can begin to address the NPSG?
Well, you know, the first thing they have to do is they have to make at least one person accountable for this particular goal. And, of course, the goal talks about having systems in place to ensure safe use of anticoagulants. So you've got to have one person, whether that's somebody who's in quality or it's a patient safety officer or something of that nature, where there's one person accountable that the organization goes to address this particular goal. And then where you go from there really depends upon your local system of care. So you really have to, obviously, you're going to have to collect information in terms of how anticoagulants are used. You're going to have to find out where there's significant variation and perhaps look at ways where that variation can be decreased. You obviously need portals of information so that if there are adverse outcomes, it gets back to the person who's accountable so they can do an analysis to find out, well, was this just an expected complication or is this background noise, or is this really something which should change how this particular process of care occurs? So the key is there still has to be one person accountable, but then once you get past that, it really depends upon your system of care, how big your hospital is, how many people are involved, and you're going to come up with different strategies based on what your hospital looks like locally.
Great. Thank you very much. Dr. Amin, question for you. Can you speak to the duration of anticoagulant drug therapy and what the research has shown?
Yeah, so the duration of anticoagulant therapy is an interesting question because the concept of extended prophylaxis versus appropriate duration is actually two different things. We certainly know in the world of orthopedics that there are national guidelines such as the ACCP that says, the ACCP guidelines that says for knees that one should do extended prophylaxis for 7 to 10 days, and for hips or hip fractures, do it for 28 to 35 days. That literature is fairly clear, and it's out there, and it's in national guidelines and so forth in terms of prevention of venous thromboembolism. The duration issue, though, is something that I think we need to really hone in on and understand better because it raises a couple of interesting questions in my mind. First of all, when a number of these studies were done, when you look at the landmark studies around MedNox or Prevent or Artemis or some of these other studies, most of them had durations patients within the hospital of anywhere from 6 to 14 days, and we don't keep our patients in the hospital, at least on the medical side, we don't keep our patients usually in the hospital for 6 to 14 days. We're keeping them in the hospital for 3, 4, 5 days as our length of stay. So when patients are coming into the hospital, they are coming in, they're usually sedentary, they have an inflammatory process going on, an acute disease state that's going on, that obviously, and they have underlying risk factors that are making them, they're putting them at high risk for developing venous thromboembolism, and making them making them into a hypercoagulable state. So, even though the studies have been out there for 6 to 14 days, we might actually be giving them prevention if we're doing it for 3, 4, or 5 days. What we don't know is whether we should actually be doing it for 6 to 14 days. The literature certainly says that. So if we're not doing that, then one could make the argument that we're not necessarily being evidence-based in terms of duration of therapy. On the other hand, there are significant barriers that exist in the local and national marketplace around giving appropriate duration. Number one is it is important that we have better research and better studies to look at when we transition the patient out of the hospital after 3, 4, 5 days. How many days should we keep them on VTE prevention? Is there a window period where, you know, maybe the first 14 days after an acute hospitalization there is higher risk, and the risk starts to go down at 30 days after hospitalization and 60 days after hospitalization? And where is that finite point that we should be continuing? Should it be long-term prophylaxis versus short-term prophylaxis? Those are all interesting questions. There are also barriers in terms of patients being able to get the medication that they need to do VTE prevention. Will the insurance companies cover the cost of those medications? Those are all important questions that are asked. But one could think about this, and I'm just raising this. One could think about this. We certainly are in our culture of practice, when we start a patient on an antibiotic in the hospital, our culture of practice says, okay, we need to keep them on that antibiotic for 10 days or 14 days or 21 days, and we will continue that. We found a way to actually say, okay, we're going to discharge them and we're going to finish the length or the duration of therapy. Now, the question comes up is, when are we going to get the science and the systems in place to say, okay, this patient got admitted to the hospital and they should have 1 month or 2 months or 3 months of VTE prevention because their risk is still higher than their normal state that they are in on a regular basis, and they're back to their appropriate activity level. So those are questions I think we need to get answered. But I think once we fix up the fact that we can get people to actually do VTE prevention in the hospital and do it consistently and accurately and do it in a high reliable situation across the country, I think there is going to be a fair amount of focus on this concept of duration and for length of therapy after discharge from the hospital.
And to that point, once the patient is discharged from the hospital, what is the role of the hospital at that point in terms of VTE prevention?
Yeah, I think that that depends on the hospital and, you know, how, whether it's got an integrated system versus not. It's not an integrated system and it's an individual hospital. I think the role of a hospital at any point in time is to ensure safe, appropriate discharge of patients and appropriate handoff of those patients back to whatever setting is going to follow that patient in, whether that's a community practice or whether a hospital ought to maybe set up an anticoagulation clinic or practice that will follow these patients for a period of time, or whether you're going to do home care, home nursing care, or have these patients come back. I do think from the concept of the hospital's responsibility is to ensure appropriate and safe discharge and appropriate and safe handoff of the patient back with appropriate communication back to whatever system they're going to have the patient follow up in.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your perspectives with us. And this concludes our interview portion of the program today. But now I'd like to invite our listeners to ask our speakers questions or to comment on what we've discussed. So we're ready to answer your questions. And please do remember to tell us your name and where you're calling from. So, Moira, if I could ask you to please tell our participants how to ask a question.
Yes, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift up your handset before entering your request. And our first question comes from Janine Gray from St. Francis Hospital. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. At our hospital, we have some physician order entry, but only in a few areas, mainly in the cardiology section. And so it sounds like that your hospital's there. It's the physicians cannot go past a certain point unless they address VTE prophylaxis. How would you have that work in a hospital? We have pre-printed orders, but they don't have to use them. And we also have a VTE prophylaxis section on all of their own pre-printed orders. And the nurses do not do the assessment. But how would you suggest enforcing, making sure that physicians, you know, address that? Because we're having to call about 200 times a month physicians who don't address it at all.
I suspect that of everyone else who's joined us on the call, there's a bunch of people nodding their heads across the country because that's a very common scenario. And there isn't an easy answer for you. Obviously, depending upon the type of hospital, everyone who has hospital privileges, any clinician who works in that hospital who has hospital privileges, is held to the policies and procedures of that hospital. But it really depends on how much will and how much interest there is at a hospital administration or a chief of staff level to enforce those policies. And a great example I would give you is just the whole issue of discharge dictation. You know, right now it's a Joint Commission standard that we must have a hospital discharge dictation that's in the chart within 30 days of hospital discharge. Any physician who practices in the hospital setting is familiar with this standard, because if we have delinquent charts, they pull our hospital privileges. We lose our parking space. We can't admit to the hospital anymore. And most physicians have figured out a way to make sure that they don't have delinquent charts in terms of discharge dictations. And it was simply based on the will of the hospital to make sure that that policy was enforced. Now, you can provide lots of passive education. You can provide alerts. You can have M&M type conferences that speak to hospital acquired events that could have been prevented that weren't. And all of this may have some impact on the physicians. You may have a physician champion that's well regarded by the hospital staff that becomes the champion for this particular project. But you're right, they will ignore pre-printed order sheets if in fact it's not something that they that's not part of their regular practice. And outside of calling them and saying, hey, listen, you forgot to put your order here, or we need this order in place, I'm not sure of any strategy short, again, of the hospital administration making this a priority that really changes physician behavior. And Alpesh, I'd be interested if you had any different thoughts.
Yeah, no, I think Dr. Mishoda hit on some very, very important points in this. I would also say that part of it is going to be achieved by education. Part of it's going to be achieved by the systems that one puts in. I don't want people to think that, we're a very rich institution, that we have this wonderful EMR and computer system that allows us to do this. We've developed this entire system off of this physician order entry and then DVT and then putting in the orders for VTE prevention. We've done that off of a 30-year-old archaic computer system and have just been very creative in working with the system to actually get to where we want to go. But it takes the steps that Dr. Mishoda is saying, which is having an active process of actually saying, time that this is important, and whatever process that you put into place at a local level, which is whether you're using pre-printed order sets, you're using an online electronic alert kind of system, it takes a commitment at the medical staff level. Changing culture around patient safety and quality is a commitment. It's a culture change, and it needs to start with physicians, nurses, pharmacists, everybody owning it. It needs to have a champion. It needs to be brought to the highest levels of the committees. The C-suite needs to endorse it, support it, back it, and one needs to measure their outcomes and then go back and say, we're missing it here and we need to do. And when people don't follow the rules, then somebody needs to actually have a stick that says, you're not following the rules, you've heard about it, we've educated you, and we now want you to, this is the outcome as a result of not following the rules.
Great. Moira, can we have the next question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Shelby Sheik with the Duke University. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. Actually, this is Yvonne Acker, and we actually have put in, we have a post-operative VTE order sheet that we use that PACU helps make sure that everybody fills out before they go to the inpatient unit. So it's been actually very successful. I did have a question, though. I think one of your speakers was saying that prophylaxis, and I'm assuming pharmacologic prophylaxis, should be offered for any patient that undergoes total knee or total hip replacement. Now, on our sheet, we do have STDs as appropriate and enough prophylaxis for a knee replacement. We model the sheet after the CHEST guidelines, and also it goes along with the SCIP CMS guidelines. And I'm just wondering, do you think there's going to be a change in that recommendation? And especially looking at patients when they go home, is there, a change in, if a patient is only on STDs for the knee replacement, is there something else that's supposed to happen when they leave the hospital?
Well, when you look at the epidemiology of DVT surrounding knee arthroplasty, about 90% of all DVTs that occur will occur within 10 days of the surgery. Although there has been some evidence that giving prophylaxis for longer than 10 days could offer benefit to some patients. But clearly the knee replacement patient is different than the hip replacement patient in terms of the epidemiology of thrombosis. SCDs have been shown to be effective in knee arthroplasty, usually with or without pharmacologic therapies on top. The efficacy, though, of those trials, and these are in the ACCP guidelines, are not as good as a pure pharmacologic approach, but the surgeon has to look at the individual risk-benefit of whatever they do, not only on the efficacy for prevention of DVT, but obviously over the concern of bleeding complications. There are devices that will allow patients to ambulate today, and they could, in fact, wear devices home. They're called continuous external compression therapy devices. They have very small portable compressors that can be recharged with a battery. They do require a unique compression sleeve that oftentimes is a little bit more expensive than the standard sleeves that we might use with a single bladder pneumatic cuff, which we often use in the hospital setting. But it is not an unrecommended approach, but I would just say anecdotally that it's not as effective in terms of efficacy as the pharmacologic approaches are to prevent DVT and knee arthroplasty.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Mm-hmm.
And our next question comes from the line of Sherry Johnson with the Randolph Hospital. Please proceed with your question.
Yes. This is Rebecca Redding. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Sorry. One of the questions that my surgeons have for the ACC chest guidelines is when a case is considered, quote-unquote, entirely laparoscopic. We could not find anything that was really a definition of what entirely meant. And then, of course, there's the SCIP definition of any extension of any of the port incisions. They are curious as to who came up with that definition for SCIP and what it's based on.
I'm not sure I can answer who came up with the definition for SCIP in regards to Frank. Do you have any comment on that?
No, I mean, I suspect that they were trying to capture one way or another a procedure that got converted to open. And so they're, you know, looking at a laparoscopic procedure, because they, you know, and whether it gets converted to open or not, because there's more data on the incidence of DVT or PE in open surgical procedures, historical data and cohort data, than we have on purely laparoscopic procedures. Most laparoscopic procedures, they don't recommend routine prophylaxis if it's entirely laparoscopic, because those are generally deemed to be procedures for which it's same-day surgery, it's short anesthesia time, and so forth. But what I would say is, as a clinician, we have to look at that, obviously, again, on an individual basis, because there are plenty of laparoscopic procedures that are actually longer than what they would have been if they were open, just simply because of the difficulty in doing this under laparoscopic guidance as opposed to open. So just because it says entirely laparoscopic to me doesn't mean that I don't have to even think about DVT prophylaxis. I think you still have to look at the patient and wonder, you know, does this patient have a prior personal history of DVT? Does this person have a family history of DVT? And in which case, it doesn't matter what the guidelines say, a prudent clinician would consider DVT prophylaxis even if it was entirely laparoscopic. Similarly, if you had a laparoscopic case that got converted to open, well, again, clinical judgment would suggest, well, maybe we apply prophylaxis as if this was an open procedure all along. So there's going to be gaps here in what the guidelines are saying and even what the quality measures are saying, like the skip measure. We're trying to define in some way what good clinical practice is, and it's hard to make it, you know, stick or fit with every individual patient. So I would encourage some sort of process that looks at laparoscopic patients as being, on average, laparoscopic patients don't need routine prophylaxis. But there should be a system in place that identifies your outliers. And if you have patients in the practice, again, who have a personal history or do in fact have a strong family history of DVT, then that guideline really doesn't apply to that individual patient. That's someone who you should now be considering DVT prophylaxis in.
Thank you.
But Dr. Mashoda, just one thing to add there. Dr. Mashoda brings up an extremely important point that, you know, at the end of the day, guidelines are guidelines, and the physician and the healthcare team need to individualize their decision making to the individual patient. And you know, underlying risk factors and type of surgery will be important predictors of your decisions around VTE prevention.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Chris Keen Hollenberg with the Anderson Cancer Center. Please proceed with your question. And the line of Christine Hollenberg is open. Please proceed with your question. If you're on speakerphone, please lift up your handset and verify your mute options. And we're going to proceed to the next question. Our next question comes from the line of Levida Corbin with the Spring Hill Medical Center. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, sir. We were just wondering if there's any literature that discusses the differences between the FCDs and the thigh high versus calf versus the footy.
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a Cochrane's analysis review by Almagiri. It was published in 2004 that looked at a variety of different devices. It was a systematic review of the literature. And the only difference between these devices in terms of efficacy was based on the length of therapy or the length of time the device was worn. There otherwise is not any good evidence that one device is better than the other. There's some small cohort evidence that the full thigh-high sequential compression device is better than a single intermittent pneumatic calf compression, which is better than aortic foot pump. But that was a single study with less than, you know, say 100 patients. And all of the devices can actually generate peak flows in the leg that are all about the same. So regardless of the device that's used, the only thing that seems to matter from an efficacy standpoint is they have to be worn continuously. And there have been four outcome studies using mechanical devices which had a placebo limb, In this case, two of them were full sequential compression devices and two were intermittent pneumatic compression devices. And they basically showed that if the devices weren't worn for about 22 hours a day, they had no efficacy compared to the placebo limb. So it probably doesn't matter which device you use, even though there might be some evidence that the bigger the device or the longer the device, the better efficacy. Based on peak flows, they're all about the same. The key is they have to be worn for 22 hours a day, or they may not be doing you anything.
There, just one thing to add there is that even though there's not a difference necessarily in the literature on the types of devices and in terms of outcomes, the thing that we run into on a practical level is patient comfort issues, and that may sometimes drive patients, but we need to do a better job in terms of, if you're going to use mechanical devices, then we need to do a better job in educating the patients to understand the importance of continuous continuous usage of the devices in terms of prevention of VTE.
Okay,
thank
I think
you.
We have time for two more questions, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Colette Fletcher with the St. Jude's Medical Center. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Question for you regarding the pharmacologic DVT prophylaxis. As you know, the ACCP guidelines have recommendations for regular monitoring of, you know, CBC, platelet count, and for the low molecular weight heparins and for the fondaparinux routine monitoring of the BMP or the creatinine. So I'm just curious if you have any systems in place that allows you to, you know, do that on a routine basis without oversticking the patient.
Yeah, well, so we have it ingrained in our institution and as part of all of our protocols follow up CBC or a platelet, even when we discharge patients out of the hospital, on the instructions for the patients and the setup of appointments, we get these tests that you just mentioned. It is ingrained in the protocols that we have set up. Obviously, we don't have a computer system necessarily that reminds people of getting it, but we've done a fair amount of education in this regard, and every one of our protocols and order sets have these things listed in there for folks to get follow-up labs on patients once they're started on these anticoagulant therapies. I think it's also going to be important as part of the national patient safety goals when we talked about earlier in regards to the fact that they're looking at safe practices in the usage of anticoagulation across the spectrum, and follow-up of labs, platelets and creatinine and HNHs are part of that whole process. And I should say one last thing in regards to it. We've gone from, in regards to the national patient safety goals, we've actually taken an approach of a pharmacy driven process. So our pharmacists have been educated to actually moving to more of a pharmacy per protocol kind of order for the usage of anticoagulants within our institution. And so we've got so if you believe that having the pharmacist own and manage this process, and the fact that they have to remember also that, you know, you started the anticoagulant today and 3 days later you need to get labs and so forth, they serve as another reminder mechanism in this process.
And our next question comes from the line of Paul Lynch. Please proceed with your question.
In the orthopedic setting, there's been debate between the AAOS and the CHEST guidelines about, you know, aspirin, and there's no studies out there that show DVT leads to PE. Can you comment on that?
Well, I'll give you my take, and then maybe Dr. Yeah. Frank, do you want to go first? Go ahead.
Well, I would just say in response to your first statement, there is randomized trial evidence that aspirin at doses of 325 milligrams dosed for 30 days does prevent DVT in orthopedic surgery. The relative risk reduction is on the order of about 20%. Unfortunately, it was associated with significant bleeding. So the chest physicians, looking at the wealth of the data on aspirin, of which some of the evidence is conflicting, basically states that aspirin may offer benefit in preventing DVT, but the benefit is not outweighed by the risk of hemorrhage. The hemorrhage, of course, that occurs when you take aspirin for a month is in the stomach and not in the wound. So there have been disagreements between the AAOS and predominantly medical specialties, although there are obviously orthopedic surgeons who participated in the chest guidelines, in regards to what value and preference that's placed on the potential bleeding that occurs with aspirin versus the potential bleeding that may occur with vitamin K antagonists, low molecular weight heparin, or fondaparinux. In terms of the studies, is there a single study that shows that anything that we use actually prevents PE? Well, there are studies in medical patients showing that unfractionated heparin TID does reduce the incidence of pulmonary embolism. And there are, in fact, overall meta-analyses data which lumps in all of the trials, granted they're heterogeneous, showing that not only does it reduce symptomatic DVT, it reduces symptomatic PE as well as mortality. And there have been similar meta-analyses that have been performed in orthopedic surgery. So if there isn't a single study that has demonstrated it, because none of them have been large enough that would have the power to actually show that difference. But the meta-analysis data is a fairly consistent signal that these strategies do, in fact, change not only venographic outcomes, but symptomatic outcomes, which includes both fatal and non-fatal PE.
Great. Well, that brings us to the end of our time today, and I'd like to thank very much our speakers, and thanks to everyone on the line for participating. Please check your email for a link to our web-based program evaluation, and by filling out the evaluation, you'll be able to request more information and suggest other topics for future programs. You also can reach us with additional questions at this email address, advisorlive@premierinc.com. We would love for you to join us again and tell your peers about the series. Remember, Advisor Live is open to anyone at no charge. Take care, everybody, and goodbye from Premier.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.